John F. Kennedy Library, President's Office Files, President's Recordings Collection, Meeting Recording Number 12. For additional information, please see Recording Log Number 12.
People you've inherited difficulties that you probably will just about settle as you get through, and then some of the fellows will come in and get all of them. That's the old story of the pioneer. There isn't a single trouble that you have that isn't a relic of either the, most of them, the Eisenhower administration, and some of them from the preceding administration, that he rolled under the rug and left for you to clean up. But the general situation is undoubtedly on the up curve. You probably place more emphasis on these colonists who are the damnedest bunch of penny liners the world has ever seen.
Or second guessers.
And the age where I no longer have any partisan political point of view whatsoever, so I get a pretty good bird's eye concept of what's taking place. Your own popularity is, of course, tremendous. The problem is to rub it off and system, as enormous explosions of populations, enormous complications of modern living, the enormous power that the growth of civilized methods is given, produces the Congress sometimes no longer as representative of the voice of people. And there have been a number of occasions recently where I'm sure they didn't vote what the people would have voted if they'd been given a chance. Now up in New York, my interest, you know, I see everybody and know everybody up there. The Democrats have fumbled their chances away with the schisms that have developed there. They can't even decide who to run against the governor, and you can't beat somebody with nobody. And the mayor, he went up and he had some great victories there for himself. But then somehow the rocket started to come down, and his power is pretty well limited now for the southern parts of the state, of New York City and its environs. He isn't going to run. He told me himself he wasn't going to run under any conditions. I really think he's never fully recovered from that operation.
I agree. He looks bad.
I think that he's got some symptoms. And whether he has physically, I believe mentally, it's gotten to him. So he isn't going to run, and who they're going to run, I don't know. Now, what applies to the schisms and the Democrats in New York State applies to the Republican Party and the rest of the country.
You know this fellow Romney? You met Romney?
Only casually. He's a very presentable man. Personally, he's with Phil Bill. It looks never. But he, to begin with, Mr. President, he is practically unknown. I tried it out. I talked with 100 people the other day, just as I happened to meet them. Sensational, he says, make it. conflagration, you've pretty well held your own. At least they haven't made any major advances along that line. I would say that the initiative that we should apply along strategic and military lines over there is lacking in at least one way. It lacks initiative. It allows the enemy to concentrate where he wishes and bring pressure where he wishes. Now we have two great forces over there. I'm not talking about our own Navy. I'm talking about the ground troops. There are about 600,000 men under Generalissimo on Formosa. And there are about the same number of South Korean and the South Korean armies. Those are two very powerful groups, and they are completely inert. Now the rain that's made upon them so that they will not be reckless and initiate a world war, of course, is correct. But in order to take the pressure away from the areas that worry you, there should be a degree of initiative applied to both those groups. In the Generalissimo's case, I believe that he should have small groups of specially trained men, not more than 100. About 10 of those groups would be landed at various spots all along the Chinese coast, give them 10 days provisions on them, tell them to go in and raise particular hell, but to be back at a rendezvous point within 10 days and pick them up. You can't send in groups like that and sacrifice and then won't do it. But if you send in groups like that, the amount of psychological damage that they can do is almost inestimable. And if you bring them back and then reward them with decorations, and in the case of the Generalissimo troops with a few dollars, you will have a professional group back for a while that will be the best guerrilla type that the world has ever seen. The result of that will be that the Red China, the enemy, like to call it that, will believe those are reconnaissances in force. He will believe that you're getting ready to attack him. He will pull his forces away, pull him away from the Indian border. He'll pull him away from the southeast there. He'll tend to concentrate his forces there all along that line. You can easily, it falls within the provisions. It should get just as little publicity in this country as is possible. You'll get enough from Formosa itself to satisfy the situation. In that way, you will not only take the initiative, you will not only confuse the enemy, but you will take what is the greatest importance, the pressure off of the Vietnamese Laos areas. Now you take the other group, and they should also tend to confuse it. Now the armistice, that unfortunate paper that was signed, gives any effort along the 38th parallel, such as guerrilla movements, really. But there should be, with a great deal of advertising, maneuvers announced. A maneuver to be announced that would tend to produce the concept that the troops from Formosa were going up to join the troops in South Korea. The use of our Navy would be that, which will bring his crowding up, his troops crowding north again instead of crowding south, which is what you want him to relieve the pressure from the south. There also should be maneuvers by the South Korean army itself.
My father is calling you.
They should land on the beaches. They shouldn't drop them. these men that will work their way from these speeches in to the various areas, and they won't know where they came from or how they came from or anything else. But if you put conventional boats in landing craft of the United States, all these drops, why, of course, you come pretty close to violating the basic concepts that are there, and you will not get what is the greatest element soon they'll use them to the maximum. That has been my hope for years, that we would, our atomic group would develop some type soldier could use says, I talked with him, and he says, I told him in great detail exactly what I wanted. He said, I talked for about 20 minutes, and he said, I could see him getting madder and madder and madder and madder. At the end of the 20 minutes, I said, now, Sir John, I forgot what he said. He says, French exploded. He says, he talked for 30 minutes. He said, by God, he couldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. He says, a goat couldn't get over that. He says, I'll lose every horse I've got. My lancers will die on the road and everything. And Birdwood said, well, what did you say to him? And Kitzner said, I said, is that all you have to say, Sir John? He talked himself out. He said, yeah. He said, now, Sir John, he says, you've given me the best reasons in the world why that can't be done. He says, now go and do it. And he did it, of course.
That's where he got to be famous, isn't he?
And they'll tell you, Papa, the same thing. It'd be a small thing to land, you know. Barely no publicity at all on it. And they'll probably tell you it can't be done. Well, I used to be an engineer, and I know enough about it, and I feel sure that they can do it.
I read that, you read that book, The Guns of August, as you could be about Sir John French.
Who?
The Guns of August. It's about the first 30 days of World War I. It's very good. It's a lot about Sir John French, who, as you know, was the commander of the British forces and not very distinguished at that time.
Yeah.
I was wondering, having read that, reading some other things, whether you thought that the leadership by the British and the French was wholly incompetent, in, well, particularly 17, Passchendaele, and all these tremendous casualties for 8, 9, 10 miles from, what, June till October, November. Was there any alternative action by the Allies? Do you think they had to continue those assaults on those trenches, or was there anything else they could have done?
I would handle the campaign in a completely different way. With modern weapons, with the machine guns, and even the weapons, I'm talking about the weapons of 1917, frontal assaults were nothing but suicide. You must envelop, you must hit the lines of supply. There's no other way to victory. You have one of these tremendous assaults that go ahead and gain 3 or 4 kilometers. They'd be so decimated and so exhausted and everything that they couldn't be exploited. And both sides made the same mistake. The German made exactly the same mistake. He down there with the, when he made that great attack through Champagne, we just slaughtered him. My division was right in the middle of the 4th French Army at that time. I put every gun of my artillery brigade on the line of the infantry. All the colonels and the brigade commanders just sweated blood. But we put them there, and they just mowed those people down two young division commanders in both. In the fourth of the thing. So I knew him pretty well. And Vagon, I knew him. He was associate in the staff, and he was the inspector general at that time. They invited me over to what they called a grand maneuver near Reims, the Champagne area there, in which they were going to test the relative merit. Horse cavalry and tanks. They were two enveloping movements, one by the cavalry and one by the tanks. They had about, I should say, 300 tanks, perhaps more. And they had two cavalry divisions, these spy divisions from Africa, and their lieutenant general with their flowing capes, you know, and everything. And those little gray steeds, you know, they just made a magnificent appearance. And in the envelopment, of course, they took 3 days to get there, and it took the tanks about 4 hours. So there was no question that the umpire ruled completely unanimously in favor of the tanks. And the decision was then made to mechanize the French army. And they had a conference in which those Marginot, Vagon, and Gamelin were present, which they called the lieutenant general of the cavalry to present his side. And he was a good talker, and he made the best of the bad situation. And then they called in the commander of the tanks, the young lieutenant colonel. I'll never forget him. Long, lean, and lank, dirty and grimed, and when he talked, his voice just poured out like Niagara Falls, and his earnestness and everything. And of course, the decision was made for the tanks. It was De Gaulle. And then the question came up after they'd made that decision of what their strategy would be if the Germans attacked. I had been in Berlin shortly before that, and they asked me whether they believed that the Germans were going to attack. I told them it was a certainty. It was just a question of time.
You need us, sir?
General Sosa.
And they I told them of an instance that had occurred when I was in Berlin. It was in Hitler's office, and an officer came in and said, a very important matter. And I said, I'll excuse myself. He said, no, he says, sit there. So I heard this this conference. I had an interpreter, and he gave it to me. And this was one of the officers that came in, was an ordnance officer. And he said that they could not produce that year more than 1,000 tanks. And the other was a general staff officer who said we must have at least 3,000 tanks. And after listening to them both, Hitler said, we will now have 10,000 tanks. And I told them of this. And I said, there's no question, just a question of time. Then they said, how are we going to meet a superior ground force of the Germans? We must go on the offensive. We all felt that. How can we get, with their superior force, a reserve force that's big enough to have an enveloping movement on the Germans when they attack? They said they needed 35 divisions to go up through the Argonne and around Belgium and turn what would be the right flank of the German attack. And it was Marginot himself that suggested, he says, along the Vosges area there, he says, we'll put up permanent fortifications. And he said, we'll be able to man them with 1/5 of the strength that we would usually put in, and that will communications to attack. And the so-called Maginot Line was put in as an offensive and has now become the symbol of defense. And when the Gelderland, meanwhile,